Today on Wings.
After interviewing former members of armed groups, Loretta Napoleoni, author of The Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks, offers a unique insight into the management of these armed organizations, the economies of terrorism.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Welcome to the Vancouver Public Library. My name is Janice Douglas, and I'm the program director. Loretta Napoleoni was born in Rome. In the mid-1970s, she became an active member of the feminist movement and a political activist. She was a Fulbright Scholar at Johns Hopkins University and a Rotary Scholar at the London School of Economics. As an economist, she's worked for several banks and international organizations in Europe and the United States. She is also a journalist and has worked as a foreign correspondent for several Italian financial papers. She's also written novels, guidebooks in Italian, and translated and edited books on terrorism. Her most recent novel, Dossier Baghdad, is a financial thriller set during the Gulf War. She is among the few people to interview the Red Brigades in Italy after three decades of silence, and this topic was the basis of her PhD. She is an expert on terrorism. Please welcome Loretta Napoleoni.
Thank you very much. I'm going to tell you the story of the making of this book, which I think is very illuminating, about how little do we know about terrorism even today. And then I'll summarize very briefly the concept of the new economy of terror, and then I'll open it to discussion. I started researching terrorism 10 years ago. At that time I was working for a bank, I was living in London, I just had a baby, who is actually sitting here in the front row, and the last thing at that time I really wanted to do was to go back to Italy and research terrorism. The reason why I did it is because I received a phone call from a friend of mine. At that time he was working for an organization that looked after the rights of political prisoners in Italian jails. And he called me and he asked me if I was interested in interviewing the Red Brigades. Now, the Red Brigades was the Italian Marxist terrorist group which was very active in Italy from the 1960s to the late 1980s. They, as a strategy in their armed struggle against the state, they did not speak with anybody for 30 years. In fact, they sat through their trials in silence. Now, this is a strategy that often armed organizations follow in order to carry on their armed struggle even after they've been arrested. An example of this strategy is Zakaria Massawi, the 20, or alleged 20 hijacker of 9/11, who is on trial in the United States and has refused to accept the authority of the United States to put him on trial. So the Red Brigades, basically, they sealed themselves in a wall of silence for 30 years. The first question I asked my friend was, you know, why the Red Brigades want to talk to me? He said that they wanted to talk to me because I was an economist, I was living abroad, I had no links with any political parties in Italy. So they thought I was going to do a fairly good job in telling the world their story. Also, as a founder of the Italian feminist movement, I had met a lot of female members of the Red Brigades, although I did not know at that time that they were also members of the Red Brigades. So the female members of the Red Brigades had suggested my name. But the most important reason why they came to me is because my childhood friend, she had become a leader of the Red Brigades. And again, I discovered it the day I opened the newspaper and I read that she'd been arrested. I must confess that I accepted to interview the Red Brigades for two reasons, which are very personal reasons. One, I wanted to understand why my childhood friend had become a terrorist. I wanted to understand what made her embrace political violence and kill people. And then I wanted to know why she had never tried to recruit me. So I decided to go back to university. I went back to the London School of Economics because I convinced the professor that I was going to do a PhD on the Italian Red Brigades. I even got some money from the university to do my research. And I went back to Italy. I spent 3 years interviewing members, not only of the Red Brigades, but also of various left and right-wing organizations. And I found the answer to my question very quickly. My friend had embraced political violence because she believed that that was the only way to break a situation which is defined in political science of a bloc democracy. Italy was a democracy, but in reality was ruled by one party for 35 years. And therefore, she believed that the only way to free the country from that condition was actually to use violence. The answer to the second question was even more interesting because I was not recruited because I failed the psychological profile. I failed every single one of the items in that profile. I was too strong-minded, too opinionated. I was judged as somebody that would only create troubles for the organization. So this is why it never came to me. Now, you must understand that the Red Brigades, as any other armed organization, is extremely hierarchical. People that join in, they join in because they want to follow orders. In order to become a leader of the Red Brigades, it takes decades. I mean, it's very pyramidal. Therefore, I was not really the right person. Now, there is something about the Red Brigades, the women's were actually, I'm not saying that they were discriminated against, but it was much, much harder for a woman to get to the top of the organization. Only two women succeeded. One was my friend. And the reason why they succeeded, I think, is because they were extremely ruthless. Now, there is something about being ruthless in this organization that almost creates a sort of charisma around the person. People start fearing you, thinking that for you it's easier to kill, because for every single one of these people, killing is extremely difficult. But that's the same thing in the right-wing groups I interviewed. What was particularly interesting is the fact that when they did the profiling for recruiting, they didn't really look at your political ideas. They looked at your personality. Personality was key because then once you got into the organization, they would mold you to whatever ideology the leadership wanted you to follow. Because the truth is that the political line and the ideology was decided by a group of, you know, 3 to 5 people. All the others simply follow. And this is when I discovered that the life of a terrorist is actually not ruled by politics, it is ruled by economics. Apart from these 3 to 4 people who actually spend their life, you know, writing various documents, deciding, you know, which line the organization has to follow, all the rest of the members of the organization search for money. They were constantly short of money. They needed money to rent safe houses, to buy weapons, to carry out, you know, new attacks. Their life rotated around, you know, raising money. And this is when I thought, this is extremely interesting because nobody had ever even mentioned the financial dimension of a terrorist organization. Now, it is possible that I came to this conclusion also because I am an economist, so I'm trained to think in a certain way. I'm not a political scientist, so I was not really searching for the ideology so much as I was searching, you know, for something different. But anyway, when I discovered this, I started asking them questions about, you know, how do you actually writing money. And they were very happy to talk to me because they were extremely proud of the way they generated cash. So I remember one story which was quite interesting. It was told by a former psychiatrist. He was a member of the organization and he was a keen sailor. He had a beautiful sailing boat. And what he did during the summer months was sailing from Italy to Lebanon to pick up weapons from the PLO, load the boat of weapons and then sail back to Sardinia. Sardinia is an island offshore the west coast of Italy. And then in Sardinia, the various Marxist terrorist organizations from Europe would go and pick up their share of the weapons. For that service, the Red Brigades got a fee, which went to fund the organization. I mean, this is just one of the many stories I was told. And at that point, I thought, to research this topic. So I tried to do the impossible. I tried to change the topic of my PhD, which is never works, of course. So I then went to university, to foundation, trying to raise money for the research, and everybody thought I was a bit odd. Everybody thought, you know, what is this woman talking about? The economics of terrorism. I even went to my literary agent and I asked her if she could get me a contract with a publisher. And my literary agency, this is in 1996, she said, why do you want to do this? Terrorism is a dead subject. The truth is that terrorism in 1996 was a dead subject. There were no more than 20 people in the world who were working on terrorism. There were no funds available. There was really nothing in terms of research. I carried on my research by myself, actually. I managed to get some funds, and also I was working with a professor from one of the universities in England. So together we managed, you know, to get some funds. Anyway, in 2000, I approached a literary agency in New York because I was watching very closely the development of Islamic terror, and I thought that they were clearly targeting American interests in the Middle East. So I thought in the US possibly there is more interest than in Italy. I got exactly the same answer. I mean, they were very polite, but you know, they said, no, thank you. I mean, there is no interest in terrorists in America. Then on September 12, 2001, my phone never stopped ringing because all of these people wanted my book, they wanted my research, and of course none of them had funded it. So the literary agency asked me to put out a proposal for a book, which I did in a month. Of course, you know, I had a vast archive and I knew quite a lot about the topic. So the proposal went out to 24 top publishers in the US. 18 commissioning editors immediately wanted to buy the book. So the agency, of course, was after the money because this is commercial publishers, decided to go to auction. And one by one, the commissioning editors dropped out of the auction. The reason is that the board of directors of these various publishing companies had vetoed the book. I was not surprised, but the agency was shocked. Now, why did they do that? The initial reasons were very superficial, ranging from in 6 months terrorism is not going to be a problem anymore, to how we're going to market a book about a phenomenon that does not exist. Okay. But the real reason, of course, were told to us later by the commissioning editors, who, of course, you know, were extremely embarrassed about what had happened. The reason why the book was vetoed is because I was presenting terrorism as an international economic system where there are charities, banks, businessmen, a system which had been in place for 50 years, an economy that was, you know, a real giant. And at that time, what editors, newspapers, politicians, the people wanted to hear was that 9/11 was the result of the action of a bunch of religious fanatics living in the caves of Afghanistan. That's what the world wanted to know. It was too early for a different analysis. Anyway, the same thing happened when we went to England. Only this time, you know, we were told a few hours before signing the contract that the publisher, again, you know, could not publish it because the board of directors had vetoed the book. So I went to Italy, because Italy is a country that's lived with terrorists for 30 years. It was a country ready for a different kind of approach than religious fanaticism. So we sold the book in 12 hours, and the publisher not only paid for my research, but also agreed to translate the book from English to Italian, which is my mother tongue. So now the book has been translated and is coming out in a few months. Anyway, I told you this story because I want you to understand that although you have read in newspapers for 2.5 years about terrorism, although you know, you go on Amazon and there must be, you know, 2,000 titles on terrorism, the truth is that this topic has been researched only for a very, very short time, and we have a long way to go. But let me tell you now what was in that proposal in November 2001. So you can understand how the publishers were shocked and could not handle it. What I did in my research, I actually looked at the economics of terrorism. Now, terrorism is a political phenomenon, and as long as it remains in the domain of politics, no worldwide consensus will ever be achieved on what really it is. I mean, what is the difference between a freedom fighter and a terrorist? I mean, if you go to Saudi Arabia today and you ask people, what do you think of Osama bin Laden? They'll tell you he's a hero. He's the guy who actually won the anti-Soviet giant. If you go to New York and ask the same question, people will tell you he's a terrorist and assassin. So, I mean, this is the limitation of terrorists. It's actually the political perspective. I think today the only decent definition is the one of Chomsky, who said, you know, a terrorist is anybody who is attacking us. And that applies everywhere. So I wanted to avoid this. So I looked at the economics. I looked at how armed organizations actually fund themselves. What do they do with the money? How do they use the money? And I, to a certain extent, ignore the ideology. And this is also because during my interviews with right and left-wing terrorist group, I discovered that, you know, they were doing exactly the same thing. As I said initially, they never discuss ideology. They only discuss money. So I retrace the birth and evolution of terrorist organization going back to the end of World War II. Now, modern terrorism is a phenomenon that took shape during the decolonization process. And I discover that armed organizations were able to build an international economic system. And I also discovered three evolutionary stages of this international economic system. The first stage is the state sponsor of terrorism, which was typical of the Cold War. This is when the two superpowers were fighting war by proxy along the periphery of their sphere of influence. And they did that by fully funding armed organizations. Now, the best example for North America is the Contras. They were, you know, created by the CIA. They were fully funded by the US, either through cover operation or legal funding. But the same we can say for the Soviet Union, who actually was funding various armed organizations in Latin America, for example, the Tupamaros. Now, the strategy used by these two superpowers were very, very similar. The United States used the CIA as a go-between the U.S. administration and the various armed organizations supported by the U.S. The Soviet Union used Cuba in Latin America and offsprings of the PLO in the Middle East. The differences were minimal. The U.S. was always cash generous, of course. The Soviet Union was not, because it was always short of cash. So they preferred to give weapons or, you know, free training. But the concept of how these two superpowers acted is exactly the same. Now, the second evolutionary stage took place in the late 1970s, early 80s. And this is what I define as the privatization of terrorism. This is when armed organizations were actually able to become independent from the sponsor by raising money themselves. Now, the best examples is the PLO in the Middle East, the IRA in Northern Ireland, and ETA in Spain. These organizations were able to create a system of sustenance, that then also a system that generated profits, and therefore, you know, they carried out, you know, their own struggle. They stopped fighting the war by proxy of the very superpower who were backing them. The last stage, which is the most interesting, because it is affecting us today, is what I define as the globalization of terrorism. That took place in the 1990s. With the deregularization of the international financial system, Western capitalism actually spread all over the world. But as Western capitalism spread, so did the economy of terrorism. The armed organizations were able to raise money cross-border. They were also able to become operational in more than one country. Now, the best example, again, is Al-Qaeda, which is not an organization like the Red Brigades, where it's not pyramidal, it's not concentrated in one country, it's not controlled by four or five people. It's actually a global phenomenon. You have Sleeper, you have Cells, you have Offspring all over the world. So we are looking at a new phenomenon, which is much, much more serious than the Red Brigades were. The globalization and the deregularization of the international financial markets also gave the possibility to armed organizations to link up with each other, so do business with each other, but also to do business with the illegal economy and the criminal economy. Now, together today, we're looking at an economy which is generating a turnover of $1.5 trillion. Now, this is twice the GDP of the United Kingdom. I mean, it's a giant, it's an economic giant. Now, I came to this figure working with an expert from the Brookings Institution. His name is Raymond Baker, and he's an expert on money laundering. And we worked together, and you know, this is the figure we came out. But recently, the IMF has actually come out with the same figure, 1.57 trillion. There are other analysts who are trying to calculate this economy, and the statistics range from $1 to $2 trillion, but still massive, massive amount of money. Now, this economy is all denominated in US dollars. If you want to go and buy weapons today in Iraq, you have to pay in US dollars. If you want to money launder money today in the Channel Islands, you have to go with US dollars. And that means this money flows into primarily the US economy. And the US economy is dependent upon this massive amount of cash. If tomorrow George Bush, by a miracle, wins the war on terror, the US economy will go into a deep recession. So this is a brief summary of what this proposal put forward in November 2001 was saying. Now, something like this was shocking for, you know, commercial publishers in the United States. And you can understand why nobody even, you know, wanted to take it into consideration. Now, today the situation is completely different, because today, 2.5 years into this war on terror, with this organization continuing to be extremely active today, everybody's now realizing that this was not a bunch of religious fanatics. It was something else. Anyway, so the book is out, which is great, because in the end, you know, I did get, you know, a publisher who believed in what I wrote, and, you know, we sold the book in translation everywhere. So things are better than they were 2.5 years ago. And I now hope that you have questions about the new economy of terror and about my research. Thank you.
Loretta Napoleoni, author of The Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks.
Okay, I'm going to repeat the question because I don't think you heard it. The question is about the suicide bombers, if they are more motivated by ideology than by money. Yes, you are 100% right. I mean, the suicide bombers are motivated by ideology. These people are not crazy. I mean, none of us will ever give up our life for money. I'm pretty sure of that. And you know, they are exactly the same. But the suicide bomber is actually a very peculiar phenomenon of Islamic terrorism. In fact, it is only a phenomenon of Islamic terrorism. There was never anything like that in modern terrorism. Why this is happening? Because these people have reached a level of despair, of desperation, that there is nothing else to do. And there is where religion gives you hope for a better life. I think the closest analogy that we can find, it is with the Christian martyrs. And it's very interesting when you go and look, the appeal that the word of Christ had at the beginning of Christianity, it was actually appealing to the slaves and to the poor people. It was not appealing to the patricians of Rome. And the same thing is happening today with the suicide bombers. I mean, Hamas recruits predominantly in areas where people have lived as refugees for three generations. There are variations, of course. I mean, what I did in my book, I did a cost-benefit analysis, actually looked at suicide bombers as commodities, because they are commodities. This is how they are defined. I mean, the leaders of Hamas actually said that the difference between Israel and the Palestinians is that Israel has the American missiles and they have the suicide bombers. And it is a weapon in their hands. But what I actually looked at the economics, I didn't look so much about the ideology. The cost of a suicide bomber is according to where the suicide bomber is recruited. They trade suicide bombers. You can actually, you know, trade from one group to another your suicide bombers. In in Palestine, the cost is often to drive, the cost of transportation, which is very high, of course, because of the securities, but also generally the family is compensated. Now, the money do not come from, predominantly, they do not come from the organization who actually is recruiting the suicide bombers, but they come from donors. Saudi Arabia is one of the largest donors of suicide bombers. But in Chechnya, the cost of suicide bombers is as low as $6 to $10, which is the cost of the explosive. Predominantly, they're women who have nothing left. Their family has been destroyed. You know, they have been raped. They have been, you know, violated by, you know, the Russian armies. And this is the cheapest place to find the suicide bombers. Sad story.
Tune in next week for more of Loretta Napoleoni, author of The Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Network. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. And don't forget our daily women's news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Homo Donans, available free online. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.